So you're ready for the game on Wednesday night now? No? Okay, you must be ready by now. Thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to Celtic Underground Podcast. This is number 197 in a long band of podcasts going back many years now. I'm Harry Brady. This week I'm joined by the one and only Hull Boy, where we talk about the performance, formation and players on who took part in the Inverness Cali Thistle game. We talk about the potential performance and players to take part in the Shakhtar game on Wednesday night, and then have a brief chat about the transfer market. If, after the crowd bit at the beginning and all of that, you're still not ready for Wednesday night, well, listen to the end and I've got some more to hopefully get you going. So thanks very much, and hope you enjoy the rest of the podcast. This is me, Harry Brady, and this is him, Hull Boy. Right, I am now joined by Hull Boy, who makes his return after his sabbatical from Twitter, for those followers of Twitter. How are you doing, Hull Boy?
I'm fine, thanks, Harry. How's yourself?
I'm excellent, thank you. I see you've not joined Eddie in his cave. You've just taken a sabbatical and you're on here instead.
Absolutely. Still plenty of things and places to discuss Celtic, so happy to be on the podcast.
Excellent, and I'm sure you'll no doubt now be getting your, putting all those missing 140 characters together into one big long character piece that will go on the website. Are you writing articles again?
Possibly.
Yeah, I didn't want you, I was going to say that before we came on, just to catch you out.
Hard taskmasters at the Celtic Underground.
Yes. As if I run it. Yes, you must provide this. You were on it before me. So, things to talk about. First up, prior to the game that people will hopefully be listening to this shot on route to, or on the morning of, or on the evening before, we had the Inverness-Cali game on Saturday. So, I will let you expand forth on your opinion on that game and performance.
Yeah, well, it was, it kind of promised to be a fairly decent game. I mean, whatever we think of Terry Butcher and his past footballing career, he seems to actually put together a kind of quite decent teams at Cali Thistle, bringing in players each year. So I thought it would be a fairly tough game, but I thought that beforehand that Celtic would run out fairly comfortable winners and be pretty much motivated from what happened in Kazakhstan the week before. But unfortunately, I think the first half was not very good at all. And obviously a decent opening goal from Cali Thistle. I think a little bit more could have been done to close the player down before he got his shot in. Kyle was a bit slow coming out, I thought. But, once we went 2-0 down, kind of we really were up against it. But thankfully, it was a much better second half. Obviously, we got the goal back from Charlie Mulgrew, which kind of set up the second 45 minutes, really. And I think Celtic kind of plugged away and plugged away. We're definitely worth the point. And I guess in some ways we could have actually grabbed all 3 points. I think psychologically, if we'd have come out of that game without any points, it wouldn't have been too good going into the midweek game this week. But I think there were some pluses as well. We saw a little bit more of Baldy. He reminds me of Marc-Antoine Fortuné in many ways.
I don't know if that's a good thing. He said there's some positives coming out of the game.
Yeah, well, I think what that does is, I think Fortuné had something about him. I think it was unfortunate that the time that he was at Celtic in terms of some of the way in which Mowbray set teams up, so it didn't really kind of do him any good.
Yeah, I think it'd be interesting if he played alongside someone like Gary Hooper.
Yeah. But I think the other big plus for me was really the way in which Adam Matthews performed. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he was playing in that kind of more advanced role on the right, he really is impressing me as a player. He's doing a lot of good things. And I quite like Lustig. I think Lustig's a good, dependable player, but who frustratingly can't seem to get through 90 minutes ever.
No. He's the new Andy Tom.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I don't know, it must be something with the modern day professionals in terms of it's almost as though they think, well, I'm going to do my job for 65, 70 minutes and that's all I'm going to do it for. You rarely get 90 minutes out of them. And it's almost as though it's accepted by the management, you know, that they're prepared to kind of say, well, we'll have that level of quality for 65, 70 minutes, and then when that time's up, we'll plug the gap with a substitution.
Yeah, I think it's Soccernomics makes the point that the first manager to really analyse that was Arsene Wenger with Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp's numbers in terms of completed passes, his running yardage run and his speed and things like that. Apparently, it was a very steep graph, downward graph, around about 60, 65 minutes. Mm-hmm. So as a consequence, Wenger then decided that he would always take Bergkamp off between 60 and 70 minutes. Yep. Because his graph deteriorated so rapidly that he would rather have 100% of a player who was 70% of Bergkamp than Bergkamp running at 60% and risking an injury.
Mm-hmm. I think the other thing to take out of the game was, I mean, obviously it was a disappointment that Kyle got injured, but even before he got injured, I'm kind of losing confidence in Kyle as a player who could come to the fore in the absence of Wanyama.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like he's going to be the player that perhaps we thought he was going to be. I thought Rogic had a steady game. I thought he played quite well. He was looking to try and be inventive in terms of unlocking the Calithistle defence. It slightly worries me that at the moment in our team, which some people might think, well, this is a childish thing, but we have got so many one-footed players at the moment. And because we've got so many one-footed players, I think it slows our game down.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things in what you said there. I think I remember somebody telling me in Kyle's first season, we were obviously making a big thing of Kyle and Izaguirre having come to the team. And somebody telling me that, I think it may have been one of the games, maybe in a Rangers game or whatever, David Moyes had come up to look because it had been suggested. And the person told me that David Moyes had come back and couldn't understand why people were talking positively about Kyle and Izaguirre, because they were no better than a whole raft of average players who run about the English Premiership, and that the only players of quality in the Celtic team were Key and Samaras.
Mm. Yeah.
Which might explain why a couple of years later, although Key has sort of seems to be slipping down the pecking order at Swansea, but it might explain why Kyle and Izaguirre are still at Celtic and Key's not.
Mm. Well, I think Key always had, I was a big admirer of Key, and I think Key always had those qualities that stand you out for kind of Premiership football in England, and for that matter, top class football elsewhere in Europe.
Yeah.
Key's ability to retain the ball, ability to do things when he's closed down with the ball. That is what people look for in the modern day footballer, certainly in terms of midfield players. And of course Key can use both feet as well.
Yeah.
So, and that is always easier for players to get themselves out of situations when they're closed down by opposition defenders.
Yeah, they don't have to do a 180-degree turn just to make a pass.
It's kind of pirouette Celtic with Mulgrew, Izaguirre, Ledley, and it's not helping us. I know Commons wasn't playing on Saturday, but he's the same as well.
No.
In fact, it's hard to think of who are the truly two-footed players within the team currently.
Yeah, I mean, you also mentioned Rodgick. My only concern about Rodgick was there's a couple of instances where he didn't get to the ball, and I felt it was because over that first, to use that football phrase, and I hate using hackneyed football phrase, but I can't think of a better way to describe it, he didn't appear to have that burst of pace over the first yard. He had pace once he was going, but that first initial couple of feet, he just seemed to lack that wee bit to me. That was my slight concern.
Yeah, I mean, you may well be right. So that could be a combination of match fitness. But I think with the sports science and the way in which they analyse players these days, maybe that's something that they can work on.
This isn't and I'm criticising him and I want him out of the team. However, if you compare the way Matthews was playing on the right-hand side in a forward position to what he created with what we have obtained out of Forest so far this season, I thought we got more out of Matthews on Saturday than we have had out of any game out of Forest this season.
I have to agree. I mean, I do like Forest, and I know he's coming for a little bit of criticism after the last week's game in Europe, but where Forrest has got ability is he can nearly always get the ball into the box if he takes a defender on. His proportion of crosses getting into the box is quite high, but it's then a question of how often he can do that. How often should he do it? Not only that, given the fact that we've sold Hooper and we don't have that kind of out-and-out striker, then who's going to be on the end of those crosses? So against Shakhtar Karagandy, Forrest, I think, delivered the ball into the box on a few occasions. Samaras doesn't have the awareness to play that kind of predatory striking role to get on the end of those crosses.
No.
His anticipation is very poor and his movement is very poor.
You criticising Celtic's player of the year this season?
Yeah, because I criticised him last year as well because he did very well in Europe but domestically didn't. And okay, Samaras has his positives and his plus points, but they're not as a central striker.
No, he's not. He's not a central striker, no.
But to go back to Matthews, the thing is, I've always said, you know, kind of football talent is not just about the ability with your feet, but it's also about the cleverness of a player. And I think Matthews has got a footballing brain, He's got the ability to think through what he's actually going to do with the ball, and what he wants to achieve with that, very very quickly. And we've already seen his adaptability, because of the fact that he's played at left back, and he was doing that when he was 19, 20.
Yeah.
You know, so it's almost like he was being pulled from his natural position to play that role, and that's a lot to ask of a 19, 20-year-old. So, you know, it's that kind of level of talent. And I think to just dwell on your point about bringing youngsters through, I think, okay, we do see glimpses of the youngsters, but when you actually see a player like Matthews, you've actually got to say to yourself, well, actually, some of these youngsters that we've been trying to bring through, they're not of that same quality.
No.
And the age gap is only 6 to 12 months, really.
Yep.
McGeoch falls into that category. You know, we all had high hopes for him. Tony Watt is another who obviously played on Saturday. I felt sorry for him because if he'd taken that chance, then the game would have been perhaps very different. But I think that more or less kind of almost summarises where Watt is at the moment with Celtic.
I thought that chance. When I watched the highlights, he didn't have as much time as it felt as though he had at the time at the game. At the game, the ball came to him. It almost felt as though he got his phone out of his pocket, sent a text message to the goalkeeper to tell him where the ball was going to go, and then hit the ball. You know, it's that sort of length of time to do it. It was very much telegraphed. He didn't need to hit it when he did. Mm. I thought it was the play of a guy lacking confidence.
Absolutely. In two ways, there wasn't much conviction in the shot, but secondly, he probably took it earlier than he should have, simply because he's desperate to score.
And I don't know whether it's the way he's been working out. Obviously, you hear many tales about his life outside of a Saturday afternoon, and it's a lifestyle that's not even as good as mine, if the rumours are to be true. His physique does not look the same slender physique it was. Now, I know he's still growing as a man, so he's going to fill out, but he does look a bit chunkier. Whether that's muscle or fat, I don't know, but he certainly looks a beefier person than he was last season.
Mm. I think the other thing is as well, it's really about where footballers have come from when they get to this stage in their career, and I think we've got to remember that Tony Watt, he's not somebody who's actually come through Celtic's youth ranks.
Yeah,
you know, he was a signing. Okay, it was a relatively small amount of money. But nevertheless, he was a signing, and so therefore, you know, if you take a footballer's career and you think, well, actually, some of their formative period is the age of kind of even as young as 14, 15, through to 17, 18, there's an awful lot of rigour and discipline and good practice that's kind of put into those players' heads during that period, and I mean, as best I can tell, I don't think Tony Watt ever had those experiences and went through that process.
No,
I think he really only started playing football seriously when he was about 17.
Which, if you then look at what we've just talked about, and we can talk about possible signings in a minute and a wee bit later, but what we've just described is Tony Watt, who, there's something not right at the moment, whatever it is. Or maybe he exceeded expectations against Barcelona. There is Baldy, who we've acknowledged is not an out-and-out striker. There is Samaras, who we know is not an out-and-out striker. And then there's Anthony Stokes, who time and time again the manager has illustrated he doesn't think he's the man for him at the very, very top level. We do have missing from our team right now.
Yep. Well, I don't know. One or two people have been talking about whether Lennon's in the mould of Gordon Strachan, and in terms of not necessarily management style, but his approach to setting out a team. And it's the big conundrum that you always have at Celtic. I think more so in the modern game that you know that you have to put a winning team out. But you want to entertain, and you want people who are creative as well. And it's how much creativity do you have in the team?
Well, it's also something you touched on when you went through the midfield, and you mentioned Birim Kayal, maybe not quite, and then you mentioned Ledley and Mulgrew. Mm. And certainly a common theme that I noticed online on Saturday night was not people saying, oh, sack the manager. It was more people voicing, I suppose what they were saying was, I have a concern that the manager seems to like players who play like he did as a player.
Mm.
So you've got Charlie Mulgrew, who is, most people now seem to have moved to the position that his best position is a centre-half.
Yeah.
Yet he's in the midfield. You get Joe Ledley, who I think Joe Ledley can be a good... When you think of some of the goals that Joe Ledley scored, it's been breaking late into the box. So it's so it looks to me like he's being told to sit.
Yep. Both Ledley and Brown to a certain extent, because Brown's still got great attacking qualities.
Yeah, and you see Brown, he's very good at picking the ball up off the midfield. He's very good at being busy in midfield, and he's then very good at getting to about 30 yards from goal and passing it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not driving on into the box like Stan Petrov, for example. So you're then starting to look in it. So the common, getting back to your creativity point, common theme for a lot of people on Saturday night was that we've got a lot of nice people who like sideway passing.
Yeah.
And very people through the middle who are direct.
Yeah. But I know I'm labouring the point, but that is also, that sideways passing comes a lot more when you've got players who are just strong on one foot.
Yes.
Because their inventiveness in terms of the creativity. If you take Mulgrew, Rogic, Ledley, Izaguirre. If an opposition player shows them onto the right foot, then the whole thing is going to go sideways or backwards.
Yep.
And that's what's slowing us down. I think the other thing as well is I thought we were going to see at the start of last season, certainly in terms of the kind of players that we bought, or we had bought the previous summer under Lennon, that we were going to see effectively a central defensive partnership that could play football, that were playing very high up the park, and squeezing the opposition, so that our midfield were more creative in their own right.
Yeah.
So, and that moved us away from what we saw when Neil Lennon played, was that you had a midfield player who would actually kind of come back and take the ball off the central defensive partnership and start the moves. And I actually think that we have players who can actually do that. So you see Ambrose pushing forward quite substantially sometimes. And that actually is when the opposition starts to panic and starts to get pulled around a little bit, providing the midfielders then add to the creativity of that move. And then obviously you need the movement up front.
Yes.
Well, Baldy doesn't have that movement at the moment. Whether he can get there, I don't know. Samaras definitely doesn't have it in terms of a central role.
No.
Stokes does have it a little bit, but even Stokes, I know he'll get you goals in the SPL, and he's obviously injured at the moment. But Stokes himself has a tendency to like to drift out, and I guess that's why it is really so vital, I think, to the whole creative ethos of the team, that we get somebody who's not exactly a clone of Gary Hooper, but who is in the mould of Hooper in terms of not just a goal scorer, but has that movement.
Lateral movement.
lateral movement, yeah. You'd be absolutely amazed if you look back at the history of Hooper's goals for Celtic, the number of times when Celtic score, whether he's on the end of them or not, and they're scored within between the penalty spot and the goal line, Hooper will have been outside of the box before that move started, and in many cases, quite deep. And yeah. So he's pulling opposition players out of position or making them doubt in the mind where exactly they should be zonally.
And obviously we're missing that, but the other thing, you mentioned Baldy there, that reminded me, was it just me, or in the first half when we were putting balls in, he just seemed to be jumping a split second too soon so that the ball would come over as he was on his way back down again? I don't know whether that was, again, lack of match practice, trying too hard or whatever, but there was about five occasions where I felt he was on his way back down as the ball came in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine if you're one of these, if you're Henrik and you can hang in there.
Yeah.
But you just seem to be jumping too early.
Yeah. And again, you don't know what that is. That could be something mental about him trying too hard. He'll be absolutely desperate to get his kind of first competitive goal. I mean, you could see what it meant to him when he got the goal in Dublin in the friendly. But he'll want good goals in competitive games now.
Yes.
So, and to a certain extent, we talked quite a bit about the midfield and Kyle, etc. And okay, they've all got their job to do. But there won't be the same kind of pressure on them. Only in a team context, as there are on the strikers to actually get goals and feel that they've got to get goals because that's their job. In the same way we said, well, what maybe took the shot too early, and Baldy's probably he's desperate.
But so one other point area that we've not spoken about, which leads us into the Shakhtar Karagandy game as well, is we've been playing with Ambrose and Wilson at the back for the first couple of games of the season. Mm. We go into Shakhtar Karagandy with Van Dijk and Moyakolo at the back.
Mm.
So we then go into the Inverness game and I'm expecting to see Van Dijk and Moyakolo at the back. And we have Van Dijk and Ambrose at the back.
Mm.
What are you expecting? First of all, was that a surprise to you? And what centre-half pairing are you expecting tomorrow night against Shakhtar Karagandy, based on the fact that unless he has Moyakolo and Van Dijk or Van Dijk and Ambrose, he's going to have a third separate different pairing in three games?
Yeah, right. I think to answer your question, I don't think it was a surprise that Ambrose and Van Dijk played together on Saturday. What surprised me was that they didn't play in Kazakhstan and that Moyakolo came in.
Yeah.
But the only reason I can think that Moyakolo came in it, Moyakolo is actually, regardless of how we view his performances so far for Celtic, he's regarded as more of a defender than a ball playing central defender and somebody who can attack. So I think Lennon, he'll have put his kind of caution hat on, make sure we don't take any unnecessary risks. And I think he probably thought, I'll go with Moyakolo rather than Ambrose, because Ambrose has got more of an attacking instinct, more of a forward instinct. So I actually think there's a logic as to that, and I wasn't surprised that Ambrose came back in. And I won't be surprised if Ambrose starts with Van Dijk on Wednesday, tomorrow night, providing they're both fit.
Yep.
Because I just think Ambrose tomorrow, obviously, it is going to be about attacking football, and it is going to be about creating even more chances and trying to break down a kind of fairly well-drilled opposition defence. So we will need Ambrose. So, no, it wasn't a surprise to me. And I actually think, and this is where I think Fraser Forster's form is possibly getting slightly affected. You need a steady, consistent centre-back pairing for Fraser Forster to be fully confident in his job and what he's got to do.
Yep.
So that he knows exactly where the two of them are going to be on set pieces that have to be defended, or, as is often the case with Celtic, how to cope with kind of counter attacks. And I don't know whether Forster's allowed a view on it as to who he prefers, but my gut instinct would be that it would be Ambrose and Van Dijk.
Well, there is a logic as to why you would ask Forster. If Forster's one of the couple of names who's straight on the team sheet, and so you know he's definitely going to be there.
Yeah.
It would make sense to me that you'd be saying, what's your preferred pairing? Whether the manager then wants to look like he's abdicating responsibility for it, I suppose he can then hardly turn around if things go wrong and say, well, that's what my keeper asked for. Yeah, well, you're the manager. So I don't know, but you would certainly, and it might make it difficult for him if his teammates found out, why didn't you like me? You would certainly like an indication as to what your keeper felt most comfortable with in front of him. I'd have thought.
Yeah.
So that conversation takes us neatly to talking about the Shakhtar game. Anyway, we need to win. Bye.
That's the understatement of the decade.
That's my team talk. Neil Lennon, if you're listening, you get the players together and say, come on, guys, we need to win. And I'm sure that will do the job. No, we need to win 3-0, 4-1 or whatever. But as long as we're 2-0 by 90 minutes, we're still in it.
Yeah, this was something that Gordon Strachan was touching on last week after the game, of saying, well, the team, the players need to focus just on getting two. It all makes it very nervy. I understand the logic of that, but it makes it all very nervy in terms of how we approach the game.
I agree. I don't think I could live through the last 5 minutes if it's 2-0 and we are pressing for a third and they suddenly get a breakaway.
Well, not only that, but I definitely don't want to see the game going into extra time or even penalties, which would be what that's going to do for the heart. I don't know, but it would just be far too tense if we were in that situation. I'm sure we'll talk about team selections, etc. But I still definitely think that they will go through. But I think it's just been very, very strange over the last few days in terms of what people associated with Celtic have been saying in the game build up. There almost seems to be this kind of like, it's not kind of overconfidence, but it's almost like a cockiness, really. It's almost as a, oh yeah, well, we can dismiss what happened last week because it was down to two silly errors in the game, and by the way, we created lots of chances and we didn't take them, so therefore, when we play this week, both of those issues will be reversed and we've got nothing to worry about. Football doesn't actually work like that, does it?
No, and it feeds into, there was games last season that we lost to inferior teams where, and I know you'll have seen this yourself, where I know football's not like this, but you are, Celtic start a game rolling over the top of somebody. And then there's a part of you that thinks, after about 10 minutes, the Celtic players thought, this team's not very good. We can beat them in second gear.
Yeah.
And suddenly we drop down a level. And all the statements from the Celtic players this week, and I would say, I know football's not as simple as that, but actually all the statements from the Celtic players this week have made me think that is exactly what they did last week.
Yeah.
Because it is almost, this is attitude of, oh yeah, they scored two goals, but hey, after 5 minutes we knew we were better than them. So we, you know, to some extent we stopped trying a bit. That's almost how it comes across.
Yeah, and the thing is, I suppose I was kind of slightly out today when I see kind of, you know, the official site are kind of putting up photos of the Shakhtar Karagandy team training at Celtic Park, and they're almost kind of like little glib statements associated with the fact that they're moving the goalposts themselves, you know. Their keepers are training ahead of what will be a really busy night for them, you know. And you just think, you really probably just need to show a little bit more respect. And if I'm sure they've thought about how the strategy of the PR is going to be before the game, and if that's what they've concluded, that they want to kind of frighten the lives out of Shakhtar Karagandy, I'm not actually convinced that's going to work in that way.
Also, first game, it was by the crowd atmosphere and the way they were playing, it looked to me, it just came across as it was. We have an immensely more higher European coefficient than they do. It was no different to us playing Barcelona. So you have players playing against a team with a named team in Europe, and they are playing this team who are so much better than them. They're playing the game of their lives, and they're playing partly for national pride as well. They're representing, this is the furthest one of their teams have gone. So the statements of Celtic players this week also seem to have struck me that seemed to come as a bit as a surprise to them. You know, they played with passion. Yeah, because they're playing for their country's pride, and they're a relatively new country.
Absolutely, and anybody who's played football at any level, if you played for a team and you get drawn in a competition where you automatically know that you are going to be playing against better opposition, your preparation is completely different for the game, and you make sure that you give everything, because by definition, you know you're playing better opposition.
So that
and you know, I think psychologically and just the way in which Celtic have made noise, I'm not making a big thing about it, but it's just the way in which they've made certain noises in the build up to the game, and you know, I definitely think Celtic will go through, but it's that kind of approach where you just start to get some kind of niggling doubts of thinking, do you know what? This could all backfire on them. And how silly will they look?
Yes, and for me, in terms of the fans' attitude, what's interesting is every Celtic fan I know thought that Celtic would win on Wednesday night and overturn it and win quite comfortably.
Yeah.
And many of those Celtic fans are now, after the Inverness game, are just not as 100% certain as they were.
No. I mean, it's just the oldest cliche that football's a funny game, and it is because nobody actually knows how that 90 minutes is going to pan out on Wednesday. But one thing's for sure, Neil Lennon and the players, they better be well prepared, and they need to be prepared as though they're going into a game against the kind of opposition that we saw in the group stages last season.
Yep. No.
Nothing half-hearted, nothing kind of elitist in terms of thinking, well, we're superior players to these. So you hope that mentality is in place.
Now, to get that right, obviously we got it. Saturday was a good indication towards what the manager was thinking about the team. What would your team be? And well, I suppose you're going to be pushed towards what you think the manager's going to do. So what do you think the team will be? Not what will your team be? What do you think the team will be on Wednesday?
Well, yeah, and that's quite a difficult one, really, because you're not actually. I mean, again, there could be some kidology around some of the injury news, but I think I suppose you've got to try and work out whether Neil Lennon will have changed his mind about anything after the Cali Thistle game. In terms of, did he say anything that maybe made him think, well, actually, I might try that on Wednesday,
yeah.
just for surprise effect. And I think if Lustig is fit, I think that he might try the Lustig Matthews combination on the right, and I think obviously he'll go with Forster in goal. I think Ambrose and Van Dijk, again, if fit, will be the central defensive pairing. Izaguirre on the left. And then I think in midfield, he'll go with Ledley and Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what he will probably do then is he may well go with Samaras in a more left side attacking role if he's fit.
Mm-hmm.
And then, well, obviously Stokes isn't going to start.
You don't think there's a chance he might play Stokes just simply because we have to get goals?
No, because I think, well, from everything that you hear, that Stokes has what did they call it, a grade one calf strain.
Yeah.
So I don't know what that means. Is there a medic in the room? But to my mind, as soon as I saw that, I just thought, well, he's out. So I think maybe what Lennon was doing on Saturday was assessing both Watt and Baldy, with a view to which one of those would start.
Mm-hmm.
And if he plays Samaras out wide left, I think he might actually start with Watt, and then hope that Commons is fit.
Just to update you on the medical side, a typical grade one calf strain will heal in 7 to 10 days.
All right, okay. Thank you, Dr. Harry. It's well, who knows? I mean, it must be going through his mind that you hope it's going through his mind that he let's put it in the negative way, that he doesn't start with Samaras as the out and out central striker.
Yeah.
Because I think it's a fine line between Amido Baldi and Tony Watt, but I would have, they are recognisable strikers. We've talked already about their abilities and where they are in the current season, but they are strikers in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't imagine that Lennon is going to start the game without Samaras, but I would prefer it if he used Samaras in the role where he has been most effective in Europe.
Okay.
What that, of course, does mean, and you did say to me, well, I want you to give me the team that Lennon's likely to pick. You'll notice two omissions from that.
One of his love children is not in that team.
Well, correct. Well, two of them, actually. Forrest and Mulgrew.
Yes.
So, and I think this is partly the frustration of supporters at the moment, is that Lennon does feel the need to certainly accommodate at least one, if not both, of those players. And right. if that's the case, then I think that Mulgrew will play in midfield instead of Ledley.
Yeah, so do I.
And I'm not convinced that would be the right thing to do. I don't have as much of a downer on Mulgrew as some people seem to have, because I actually see his qualities at set pieces, and he's not always on target, but there is that option. And if Commons doesn't make it, then you actually do need somebody who is going to be pretty good on delivery at set pieces.
I mean, what I actually find in relation to the Mulgrew issue is you find yourself being... I like Mulgrew and I think he's a good player and he's done a great job of creating a role for himself, but you find yourself sounding like you're being very critical of Mulgrew.
Yeah.
When you're not really... I suppose what you're being is you're being critical of a manager who appears to be... He gets his team together and he writes down Fraser Foster, Chris Commons... James Forrest, Charlie Mulgrew,
yeah,
on a piece of paper, and then
works
out how to put the team around that.
Correct.
And correct. So then ends up putting Charlie Mulgrew into places where I would argue that Joe Ledley is a better midfield player than Charlie Mulgrew.
Yeah, absolutely.
So why does Charlie Mulgrew get in the team ahead? Because, and this is where I do think Lennon, I found both Strachan and O'Neill did this. You got the impression... Yep. That they picked, if there was a guy who never let them down,
yep.
Stephen McManus, for example, for Gordon Strachan, not
yep.
the most spectacular centre half, but he didn't have a spectacular game followed by standing on the ball.
No,
he was solid. The manager knew what he was going to get from, and he didn't let him down.
Yeah,
and my criticism is not a criticism of Mulgrew; it's a criticism of Lennon that he's picking Mulgrew ahead of. Birim Kayal, Joe Ledley, Rodjik, any number of midfield players you could name at the club, he's picked Mulgrew ahead of him, when I think Mulgrew's a centre-half.
What you find as well is that there's there seems to be almost an acceptance about certain players in terms of are they good enough for the SPL? Yes. Are they good enough for Europe? Well, probably not, so we only use them on the subs bench or in emergency. And there's almost this kind of unwritten recognition that Anthony Stokes falls into that category.
Yep.
But one could argue exactly the same case with Mulgrew. Can Mulgrew cut it at SPL level? Yes, he can. What about at European level? Well, I think not, and quite a lot of other supporters think not. But the manager seems to take a different view on that.
I mean, I would rather Mulgrew didn't start. I would rather Stokes did start. Stokes annoys me at times, but I would rather he started on Wednesday night. And I think James Forrest is far more effective if he comes on with 30 minutes to go on Wednesday night. When hopefully we have been playing most of the game in their half and they have been chasing the ball, and suddenly we've got a guy who's going to run right at them.
Well, I mean, you're right there. And again, just to emphasise this issue of the lack of, if you like, a replacement for Gary Hooper at this stage, which temporarily could be the likes of Stokes and Baldy, etc. But if you don't have that quality in that central striker role, that is, I think this is what you were hinting at, that really has a knock-on effect in terms of the effectiveness of Forrest and Commons. And we actually saw that in the away leg in Kazakhstan.
Yep.
Commons, it just didn't have an out ball a lot of the time because he was playing alongside a central striker who was simply not on the same wavelength.
Yep.
Whereas when he plays with Hooper... You know, I'm not saying it's telepathic, but there's clearly an awareness of what was going on, and that's similar with Stokes.
Now, which then, you know, we've gone through a team, and you know, we hopefully will win. But we've touched on a couple of times about the need for a striker, which then the Shakhtar game, our lack of a striker, and the Shakhtar money and the money that can be generated if we win or don't win this game. All feed into our transfer strategy. Do you think we should have bought a striker for this game?
I think we should have. Yes. I think what we forget sometimes is there's a big difference between should have and the ability to actually get the players.
Yeah, should have and could have.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's a massive topic at the moment across the support in terms of, you know, you lose your spine of your team last season, and arguably all three of those players, unarguably all three of those players need replacing. What is arguable is whether they have been replaced in part by people that we have signed, or an expectancy that players that are already on the books will come through and kind of fill some of that role. The thing for me is, in terms of a striker, and obviously Finn Bogason's been talked about. My guess is, and it's only a guess, that at this stage, I don't think it would matter how much money Celtic offered for the player. And if Heerenveen accept the price, I still think the player would think twice about coming, or his agent would, and would say, sorry, but I'm only coming if you've got Champions League group stage football guaranteed.
Well,
because I'd rather hedge my bets and stay in Dutch football than play in the SPL.
And that is what I can hear. I mean, I want a striker too, but I can just hear what, if you were speaking to Peter Lawwell, Peter Lawwell would say, well, I bought replacements. We bought Moyakolo and Van Dijk. So we bought two centre-halves and we sold one.
Yeah.
We bought Baldy and sold Gary Hooper. And then you would quite rightly turn around and say, yes, but they're new players and Baldy's not Gary Hooper's level. And he would turn around and say, so what you're actually saying, it's not about buying replacements, it's about replacements who are at least as good as the guy who's gone. Well, that's fine. I take that point on board. Now, I know Celtic Rumours, this was tweeted by Eddie, and people were a bit dismissive. I know where he got it from, and I have reason to. It makes sense to me, and I have reason to believe that the person was correct, that there are at least four players that Celtic have spoken with who have said exactly what you've just said, of the standard we want, but they've said, and I'll come when you've got guaranteed Champions League football. So I can just hear Peter Lowell saying, so I can buy another three Amido Baldies. I can buy another three Amido Baldies if you want, but they're all going to be no better than Amido Baldy. Or I can not sign anyone, we get Champions League football, and I can go out and buy a Finn Bogason. And if we get through, and in the next 3 days we sign a Finn Bogason, it's been the right strategy.
Yeah.
He could argue, well, I couldn't have bought any better quality player to take us to the next level because they just wouldn't come.
No. And I think that's the thing for me. I mean, it's as I say, it's, you know, if Celtic started offering really silly money because they're desperate for that player to come, it's no guarantee that the player will come. You know, the clubs can agree a fee. We saw it with Wanyama. Wanyama's agent was obviously touting Wanyama around English football this summer. But Wanyama was already given permission. A fee had obviously been agreed, and Wanyama was given permission to talk to a club. But Wanyama didn't want to go to that club.
Yep.
So, you know, the power, and I'm not saying it's the player's decision alone, because it's often their agent. But I think it's the same with this Timo Pukki. I think his agent will be in his ear and saying, you just sit tight, You just sit tight. You're playing for Schalke. You're playing in a bigger league. You might not be on the best of money, but let's just see what happens here. If Celtic get through to the Champions League group stages, then you've got a platform.
And I think part of that then does cause a problem in the European transfer market, having the last Champions League qualifier so close to the end of the transfer window. Yeah. Well, because actually there's not been massive amounts of business done across the board.
No. Well, you've got to remember as well that Celtic's wage philosophy, if you like, people talk about the wages and the wage cap. Well, actually, the key element of the Celtic wage philosophy is relatively small basics, but relatively high bonuses.
Yep.
And those bonuses come predominantly in terms of hard cash through getting to the Champions League group stage and then playing in those Champions League group games. So a player's agent will not be advocating that a player signs without the guarantee of that kind of wage income that's going to come through the bonus structure.
And then getting back to your point about just saying to the guy, okay, well, we'll pay you a fortune just to come now. So you pay somebody, for argument's sake, £45,000 a week.
Yep.
We absolutely have to sell that guy inside his first term of contract.
Correct.
Because we can't do anything but give him a pay cut in his next contract. Mm. I mean, I do wonder whether that's why we haven't started contract negotiations in depth with Joe Ledley.
Yeah.
Joe Ledley came on a free transfer because at the time he was a notional £4 million player.
Yeah.
So we gave him a decent... My understanding is he's up there with Brown as the top two players at the club.
Yeah. Yeah.
He wants to stay. And so how do we renegotiate a contract on when he's already at the ceiling of our pay structure?
Mm-hmm. Exactly, and the thing is, you know, I mean, okay, I'm trying to put some logic into it. It is incredibly frustrating, you know. I want Finn Bogason at the club yesterday. You know, well, before yesterday, I wanted him in before last week's game. But I guess sometimes we get so kind of wrapped up in our demands for wanting players signed. When there are kind of a range of complexities and competing priorities between those people who are involved in bringing that deal together. And I mean, the obvious thing is for a lot of people is then to say, well, it's the board's fault, it's Peter Lowell's fault. And I'm not quite sure it's as simple as that.
Like most things in life, it is very few things in life are that black and white, but it's that or that.
Mm.
And I do think our inability to offer Champions League football is a major, major factor. You know, as I said in the podcast with John Paul Taylor, I don't know if I put it on or if I spoke to him, we must be the only fans in Europe, in the top league in Europe, who on the first day of the season knew absolutely we were going to win the league. Now that then becomes a challenge of why would a player coming is going to know that?
Yeah.
And they want a challenge to play in, so it's not that straightforward to bring them in. And also I'm not defending this position, but I can also understand if you're the board the concept of we can spend money on the team. This team will absolutely win the Premier League, so we don't need to spend a penny on it to win the Premier League. And spending £15 million on this team will not increase our likelihood of getting beyond the last 16 in Europe. So there's also the board, much as people criticise the board for making economic decisions, there is an argument that if we sign anybody after qualification for the Champions League, there's no economic argument to signing anyone because we're already in the Champions League, we're already guaranteed the money. You know, it's the old adage of keeping Gary Hooper was not the difference between getting past Juventus or not getting past Juventus.
Mm.
So any signing that the board make in the next 3 or 4 days, if we beat Shakhtar, there is an argument that it's a fan-based decision and it's not an economic one.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is for me is that at the end of the day, I know we have to take cognizance of the business parameters of all this, but at the end of the day, what the support wants to see is they want to see good players. Even though they know that they may win every SPL game, they want to be going to a game and they want to be entertained with good football and by good footballers. And if you think it through logically, leaving aside all the monetary amounts, Wanyama and Hooper were great players to watch. And people were enthused, you know, going along to an SPL game to see good players. And OK, it might have been disappointing on that particular Saturday or Sunday if they had an off day. But people wanted to see that. And I think that's where the Celtic board have got to make sure that there are always players that are going to, you know, you can do the maths on the business side and say, yes, well, we're not going to invest that amount because we don't need to, because we're going to win the league anyway. But they need to think very carefully about making sure that the team on the park has sufficient entertaining players to keep people coming to games and talking about the games.
And I suppose that's
the critical thing.
Yeah, and I suppose the point I'm making is I agree with many who at times despair that the board are a bit too prudent in their financial outlook. But I'm just sort of raising the counter argument that if they were as prudent as some people say, even if we beat Shakhtar, we wouldn't sign anyone.
Yeah.
That, to be fair to the board, they're not quite as hard-nosed as some people criticise them for being.
They'll definitely sign. I mean, the other thing to think through as well is, you know, if Celtic go through tomorrow night, you can bet that there will be a few emails and texts flying in from other players' agents who haven't been on the radar previously.
Yes,
who might say, we've got a player who we think may be interested in coming and playing for you now that you are going to be playing Champions League football.
Yes, because that agent and Celtic also know that Victor Wanyama of Celtic, of Europa League last eight, yes, Celtic, is not worth as much as Victor Wanyama of Champions League last 16 Celtic.
Absolutely.
Just so that people don't have too long a podcast to listen to, we should probably bring this to a close with me asking two questions. With three questions, actually. I'm going to do this the Monty Python thing. Three questions.
Are we going to beat? Yes,
four questions. Are we going to beat Shakhtar and what will the score be? And are we going to sign people this week?
We're going to beat Shakhtar. That's the answer to the first one. We will beat them 3-0. And yes, we will sign players.
Okay, I will hold you to that and come back and beat you up if that's not the case. Okay, oh boy, thanks for that. Cheers.
Mulgrew across. Mulgrew, left-footed corner, in towards the far post. Header in! Precisely what Celtic need. Celtic 1, Barcelona 0.
Yes, a wonderful start for Celtic. Great delivery by Mulgrew. Left foot, in swinging corner, right over the top. And there was Wanyama. He out jumped his marker, and his marker was Song. Quite clearly, much more powerful than Alex Song, and he headed into the back of the net. A wonderful start for Celtic, and a thoroughly deserved header from that corner kick.
Oh, the ball breaks forward. It's an opportunity.
Watt
for history. Watt makes it 2-0. Sensational. The 18-year-old has only been on the pitch a few minutes.
Wonderful.
It's a long clearance upfield by Celtic. Watt was after it. Threw into the penalty area. Right foot shot. No pass fouled it. What a night at Celtic Park.
Here comes Tony Watt. What a moment for Watt.
Yes.
Football club are on the verge of one of their greatest ever
don't be afraid of the dark. At the end of a storm, there's a golden sky and the sweet silver song of love. Walk on.